Side 5, Eon, by Greg Baer. Continuing on page 171. Okay, he said. He wanted to leave, but he couldn't. So we're both human. Is that what you wanted to know?
I'm working, Patricia said. But inside I'm just bloody. Maybe that's it.
Quickly, he wiped his eyes. I'm not a snowball, he said defensively. And it isn't fair to expect anything more from me right now than what I'm giving. Do you see that?
This is really peculiar, Patricia said, lifting her hands to her face as if to mimic him.
Her fingers went no higher than her cheeks, which were hot.
I'm sorry, but you followed me.
I followed you. Shall we leave it at this? Patricia nodded, ashamed.
I never thought you were cold.
Fine, Linnea said. He turned and walked quickly toward the cafeteria. In her room, she pressed her fists into her eyes, now dry, and tried to mouth the words to a song she had dearly loved as a child. She couldn't quite remember them. I wasn't certain she remembered them correctly.
But wherever you go, she ventured to accompany the tune, whatever you do, I'll be watching you.
Chapter 19. Patricia sat in a director's chair on the roof of the women's barracks. She glanced at the date on her watch, as those attending the dance gathered in the science team compound. The war was scheduled to begin in 7 days. Everything was coming down on her too quickly. She could render opinions, but she could not convince herself of their accuracy. She could, for example, tell Lanier that the stone could not have been shunted very far from its original continuum. Stone history and their current reality would not differ substantially, perhaps not enough to prevent war.
Perhaps the Soviet knowledge that a war was imminent would turn them around, make them back off, prevent the war. Perhaps the presence of the stone and the clear technological advantage that it gave to the Western Bloc countries would push the Soviets over the edge anyway.
Perhaps the stone simply made an effect and canceled that effect, and would leave hardly a ripple on the immediate future of the Earth. Carlson and Lanier entered the compound. Patricia could see them greeting team members as they arrived from the other chambers. The ragged, bloody feeling inside had passed. She didn't feel angry or sad. She didn't really even feel alive. The only thing that gave her any joy now was sinking into the state, continuing her work, bathing in the brilliance and majesty of the corridor. She would have to make an appearance, however. She expected it of herself. Patricia had always resisted playing the reclusive genius and avoiding contact with others. Resisting was not the same as denial of the urge's existence. She did want to stay away, to go to her quarters and work. The thought of dancing under the eternal tube light, the dance was being held in the open, and making small talk, essentially of going on the social roster, if only for a few hours, frightened her. She wasn't sure she could maintain her temper, the balance that kept her from dissolving into tears of rage and frustration. She descended the stairs and left the barracks, hands in pockets, forcing her chin higher as she approached the milling crowd. Two soldiers, two biologists, and two engineers had built their own synthesizer and electric guitars out of discarded electronics. The story had been circulating for some weeks that the band was tolerable, perhaps even good. This was their first time in front of an audience, and they seemed coolly professional as they tuned and adjusted the amplifiers. Loudspeakers of a peculiar design had been cadged by archaeologists working in Alexandria and offered up for the dance as a kind of goodwill sacrifice, an atonement for their fussy protectiveness. The speakers had been set up at corners of the rectangular dance area, an unused acre reserved for future buildings. No wires went to the speakers. The music was broadcast to them on a special frequency through a low-power transmitter. The sound coming out of them was somewhat metallic, but they were serviceable. Heinemann inspected one casually and said, "I'm not sure what this is. It isn't a loudspeaker." "It's working, isn't it?" Carlson said, sticking close to her intended dance partner. Heinemann agreed that it was producing sound from the beamed signal, but went no further than that. The question was never satisfactorily settled. Beneath the steady tube light, security team members took turns dancing with the scientists and technicians. The Soviet group stood together to one side, playing wallflowers. Hua Ling, Wu, Zhang, and Farley joined in energetically, though they had already been informed of the shutdown. The band switched to older acid rock for a few selections, but that didn't suit the mood, and they reluctantly returned to more modern music. Patricia danced once with Lanier, one of the Japanese waltzes that had become popular in the last few years. At the conclusion, as they held hands at arm's length and bobbed around one another, Lanier nodded mysteriously and smiled at Patricia. She felt a flush work up her neck to her face. At the dance's conclusion, he held her close and said, "Not your fault, Patricia. You've done great. A real team member." They separated, and Patricia retreated to the sidelines, confused, her sensation of nullity broken. Had she really expected or wanted approval from Lanier? Apparently, his words pleased her. Wu asked her to dance and proved to be a capable partner. She then sat out the rest of the festivities. Lanier rejoined her during a break. He had been dancing rather feverishly with a number of partners, Farley and Zhang among them. "Enjoying yourself?" he asked. She nodded. Then she said, "No, not really." "Neither am I, if the truth be known." "You're a good dancer, though," Patricia said. Lanier shrugged. "Have to stop thinking sometime, right?" She couldn't agree with that. There was so little time. "I have to talk to you," she said.
"On recreation time?"
"Is here okay?" she asked simultaneously. The noise was loud enough that they could hardly be overheard.
"As good a place as any, I suppose," Lanier said.
He looked around for Takahashi. He was on the opposite side of the dance quad, nowhere near the Russians. She nodded, and again her eyes filled with tears. Because he had said something nice to her, now she would open up and express her worst fears, her darkest opinions. "I've tried to calculate how big a snap the corridor's creation would have given the stone."
"How big?" Lanier asked, keeping an eye on people passing close enough to hear.
"Not very big," she said. "It's a complicated question, but not big at all."
"We're on, then."
Her throat tightened. "It's possible. Is that why you really wanted me on the stone? Just to say that?"
He shook his head. "Hoffman wanted you here. She told me I was responsible for you. I just put you to work." He reached into his pocket and brought out an envelope, opening it and withdrawing two letters. "I haven't been able to give you these before." "No, amend that. It slipped my mind until now. I brought them back with me on the shuttle."
She took the letters from his hand and looked at them. One was from her parents, the other from Paul. "May I write back?" she asked.
"Say anything you like," he said, "within reason." The postmarks were a week old.
A week passed. The day scheduled for Armageddon passed. Patricia stayed in her quarters, working harder than ever with the resources left to her. She could not change her initial opinion. Each day, then, was a victory, with reality showing her how wrong she could be. Chapter 20. Lanier exited the elevator and took hold of the cable, maneuvering into the cart. The slightly built driver, a woman in Air Force blue coveralls, moved the cart off its normal route and followed a track into Kirchner's staging and practice area. Lanier had been there only twice before, each time to meet with the Admiral. He clung to the cart hand grips and tried to prepare an answer for the questions he knew would be asked. Hoffman had hinted in her last communication that the information she had given him had finally reached the Joint Chiefs. That meant Kirchner and Gerhardt had it now. Gerhardt's aide met him in the short tunnel before the converted cargo storage area where Kirchner's borehole team practiced. He led Lanier into a bare rock cubicle lined with makeshift file cabinets. One wide vein of nickel iron had been polished and wirebrushed to serve as a projection screen. Kirchner floated into a harness, viewing readouts on a slate, as Lanier was escorted in and announced. Gerhardt pushed himself along the hall and entered after him. Kirchner nodded at them both. The Admiral did not appear comfortable. "Mr. Lanier used to be Lieutenant Commander, did it not?" Gerhardt asked brusquely. He was a squat, trim man with wiry black hair and a broad, squashed nose. His dress differed little from that of his Internal Defense Marines, green uniform, black boots with soft rubber soles for traction. "Yes, sir." Lanier waited out the pause. "You did not inform us that Takahashi is a Soviet operative, Mr. Lanier," Kirchner said.
"No, I did not."
"You learned of this almost 2 weeks ago and did not inform your security team leaders of the breach?" Linnea said nothing.
You had your reasons, Kirchner offered.
Yes.
May we be informed?
Gerhardt asked, his tenor voice tightening slightly.
It was our intention to give the Russians a little breathing space, to let them see we were backing off. We could not do that if Takahashi was locked up.
Which I would have done, Gerhardt said.
Linnea nodded.
You're right. I would have. Do you realize this could put our whole operation in jeopardy? Takahashi could have witnessed our maneuvers here, our preparations for the assault.
No, sir. He's kept to the compound except to send messages.
Kirchner, his usual taciturn self, was letting Gerhardt administer the dressing down.
And he's been sending those messages right over our heads, right along with our alignment beams for OTV docking.
Wonderful. I am arranging for his arrest now. I want him shipped back to Earth immediately, and I want him tried for treason.
Christ, Gary!
Gerhardt shook his head vigorously, as if to frighten away insects.
Hoffman wanted this?
She implied it.
She gave you the name. Any results? I mean, have the Russians decided to negotiate yet?
No, not that I've heard.
You're damned right they haven't. They know what we're holding here. You expected them to believe we would just pull back and share it all with them?
I thought we needed a breather. Chance to reassess.
Did Hoffman know what information Takahashi was passing along? Kirchner asked.
Yes, material about the libraries.
Jesus, Gary, the Crown had access to places Kirchner and I can't go. If you ask me, you've screwed this operation up royally. Is there anything I should know that he knows, or that your sweet little female student has learned?
Yes, undoubtedly, Lanier said, keeping calm, letting the general blow off steam. And you know I won't tell you. You'll have to ask your superiors.
Gerhardt smiled.
Yes, a president. Off the record, Gary. A president who's living in some antebellum dream of democracy. Can't even talk about space, much less think about it. A Senate composed of his stooges and ass-backwards Republicans grinding out bills on southern reapportionment.
He glanced at Kirchner, who shook his head, smiling slightly, and looked off at the asteroid rock wall.
Nobody's giving half the attention to the stone they should. Or am I wrong?
You're right and wrong. At this moment, I don't think there's any more important topic to the governments of the world than the stone. Everybody's speculating. The Russians are scared shitless. We'll have a technological drop on them. We already do, but the stone cinches it, doesn't it?
What are Kirchner and I doing up here, Gary? Why aren't we kept informed like you? The stone's security relies on the captain and me, but those bastards have pulled curtains around us. We can't get into the libraries, can't see documents. I don't understand. Some of the weirdest things I've been hearing. It's going to drive me nuts. Isn't it time we cooperate with each other?
They have their reasons, Lanier said.
I've watched you, Gary. You've gone downhill the past year. I don't want to know your secrets for my health's sake. What in hell have we got here?
Lanier pulled himself into a second harness and gripped the straps. What are your orders from Earth, Oliver?
I am to prepare for imminent assault on the stone and for the possibility of nuclear confrontation on Earth.
Can the Russians take the stone?
If they put everything they have in space against us, yes, Kirchner said.
Do you think they will?
Yes, Kirchner said. How, I don't know. But we're thinking day and night, trying to second guess. On our next close approach, they'll use little skirmishes on Earth, at sea and in Europe, to distract attention from the stone. Then they'll come at us and try to take it from us. Or they'll try the stone first. I don't know.
Can they succeed?
Gerhardt raised his hand to interrupt.
Will you level with me on what we're facing, Gary, and let me lock the bastard away?
Takahashi had probably served his usefulness.
Yes, Lanier said. Get him off the stone as soon as you can. Let the State Department take care of him once he reaches Florida.
You'll let us into the libraries? Gerhardt asked.
No, they're closed. I'll tell you what you need to know.
Then I'll answer your question, Kirchner said. The Russians can succeed. They can take us over. If they put everything they have into it, we can't really stop them short of sealing off the borehole, and we can't do that without sealing ourselves in. We've been ordered not to do that.
Of course, Lanier said. That would have ended all doubts for the Russians.
Good talking with you, Gary, Gerhardt said sharply. Now let's get busy. and move those sons of bitches off the stone.
Only Takahashi. Don't touch the Russian team.
God, no, Gerhardt said. We won't do that until it's too damned late for anyone to be sensitive.
Chapter 21. Within the belly of the ocean-launched heavy-lift cargo vehicle, Battalion Commander Colonel Pavel Myuski listened to the technicians of Orbital Sentry Platform 3 refueling the tanks surrounding and below the cramped aft compartment, preparing them for the next step of the journey. Myuski had learned to enjoy weightlessness. It reminded him of skydiving. He had spent so much time falling from airplanes and floating in the bellies of falling airplanes in Mongolia and near Turatam, and experiencing the real thing during his training in orbit, that weightlessness seemed only natural. The same could not be said for many of his men. Fully a third were in the throes of desperate space sickness. The three tight, stuffy compartments, stacked atop one another along the heavy lifter's center line, had not been designed for comfort. The orange bulkheads and dark green quilted pads snapped over most surfaces did little to make anyone feel secure. The troops had already spent 20 hours in confinement. In that time, they had been subjected to the stress of liftoff and now weightlessness. The motion sickness medicines had turned out to be long past their shelf life, pharmaceutical antiques in plastic bottles. Myuski took such things in stride and offered what support to his men that he could. "What do you think of history now, eh, Victor?" he asked his deputy commander, Major Victor Garabedian. "Fuck history," Garabedian said, waving his hand listlessly. "Shoot me now and get it over with." "You'll be fine." "Fuck health." "Drink some water." "Yes, and fuck it too, if you wish." They hung in their slings in the forward compartment, surrounded by the smells of sickness and tension, and the sounds of men trying to be quiet, lying in their slings, some eating out of ration pouches and tubes, most not. When they had launched out of the Indian Ocean, just over the southern extremity of the Carpenter Ridge, they had used a slot scheduled for resupply of a near-Earth sentry platform. They were the fourth of seven heavy lifters, one launched from the moon. The seven bore the code names Zeal, Chaika, Jiguli, Volga, Rolls-Royce, Chevy, and Cadillac. Three of the heavy lifters, including Volga, their own, carried generals, codenamed Zev, Lev, and Nev after a popular comedy dance troupe. Six of the ships carried 200 men, and the small arms and contingency supplies they would need if they succeeded in the first part of their mission. The seventh, Jiguli, carried heavy artillery, extra supplies, and 50 technicians. If they did not succeed, there would be no need for more supplies. If they did, they would be able to live for years without support from Earth or Moon, so the tacticians had claimed, based on their intelligence. Myuski wondered about details that had not been included in his briefings. The method of entry seemed logical enough. There was only one way in and one way out, both the same. The heavy lifters were masked, supposedly difficult to detect. Great dark bloated cones topped by three blisters containing the cockpit and weapons. Leading surfaces of the vehicles were armored beneath their disposable heat-diffusing panels. The armor had been covered with reflective anti-laser shields. How much that would help them as they entered the very throat of the beast, best not to think about that. He shut his eyes to review their actions once they had entered. Each of them carried a lightweight spacesuit in a plastic bag, bulky helmet strapped to one side with coiled and tied connectors, backpack with 2 hours oxygen and battery power, and in another bag, a parachute and a folded aerodynamic shield. Each also had a kit containing small vapor propellant rocket. The rockets had three nozzles only a few centimeters across, aimed radially outward when attached to the bottom of the backpacks. They were controlled by buttons on flexible cords that laced through loops and fit into pockets just below the gloves. The nozzles in their plastic packages were folded inward, and the propellant sloshed gently when moved. So equipped, clutching their laser rifles and Kalashnikov AKV-297 vacuum projectile weapons, just machine guns with bigger clips and folding stocks, modified not to jam in airless condition, they proposed to win back the honor and historical place of the Soviet Union and its concerned allies. Not that their briefings had included such phrases. No leader would ever admit that honor and place had been lost. Myuski was a practical man, however. In the half-darkness, another man began retching miserably.
Perhaps they would be over it in a day or so. That is what the medical experts had told them. No worse than the first few days on a troop ship. Russians had spent enough time in space that what the experts said had to be based in fact. He tugged on his sling. When the time came, it would convert into a harness. They would all be hitched to the dispersal trolley and pushed, one by one, out of the ship. From that point on, they would be free agents until they gathered within the potato, the stone. Mirsky wondered how the borehole was defended and what lay beyond. Details were tantalizingly specific, while the overview remained sketchy. They had been told the absolute minimum necessary to let them do their work. No objective in orbit had ever been assaulted by troops before. There was no way of knowing, or even guessing, everything that could go wrong. Not that any soldier had ever expected to live through a battle. In the Great War, his grandfather had died along the river Bug when Hitler's troops had made their first crossing. And of course there was Kiev. Russians knew how to die. Chapter 22. Hoffman had taken only the most essential items, 7 high-density memory blocks out of perhaps 2,000, a few personal effects, and 2 pieces of jewelry given to her by her late husband 10 years before. She had left the Taos home with the doors open. Should any vagabonds chance upon it, she would let them have a few days of pleasure. There was nothing more she could do. She had asked for a few return favors. There was no doubt what was going to happen within the next 4 days. No one she had talked to had ever seen tensions so high. Operating on the instinct which had served her so well in the past, Judith Hoffman was on her way to the stone. She hoped she hadn't started out too late. She drove the innocuous second car, a leased Buick, for hours across the desert and open countryside, through small towns and medium-sized towns, trying not to think or feel guilty. There was nothing more she could do. She had been stripped of all authority by an angry and foolish chief executive. 3 cabinet members had accused her of actually starting this entire mess. "The hell with them," she whispered. Beside the turnoff to Vandenberg Launch Center, in a small complex of civilian stores serving the base personnel, she saw a garden shop. Without hesitating, she pulled into the parking lot. Inside the store, she found a skinny young male clerk in a leaf-green apron and a Robin Hood hat. She asked where the seed racks were. "Vegetable or flower?" he asked. "Both. Aisle H, just across from hand tools, next to mulch." "Thank you." She found the racks and took one package of everything she could see, 2 or 3 of some of the vegetables and fruits. When she was done, her basket was filled with about 10 pounds of seed packages. The clerk looked at the pile in bewilderment. Hoffman threw $200 bills down on the counter. "Will that be enough?" she asked. "I think so. Keep what's left over," she said. "I'm in a hurry, and I don't have time to count them all." "Let me get the manager." "I don't have time," she repeated, and she took out another bill and laid it next to the 2. "I'm sure that will cover it," the clerk said quickly, swallowing. "Thank you. Put them in a box for me?" Hoffman picked up the box and returned to the car. Lanier was asleep in his cubicle when the comm line chimed. He reached over to press the button, but no message awaited, only silence. He rubbed his eyes, clear, blinking. Then he heard the other comm lines in other rooms throughout the barracks, all chiming. Footsteps sounded in the hallway. He punched a number into the unit. A shaky voice answered, "First Chamber Communications. This is Gary Lanier. Are we having a central alert?"
"Yes, Mr. Lanier."
"Why?" Lanier's voice was infinitely patient.
"I'm not sure, sir."
"I want to speak with Axis Communications right now."
"Yes, sir."
When a woman's voice answered some seconds later, he requested a briefing.
"We have DEFCON 3 from London and Moscow," the woman said. "Radar activity is up, especially orbital tracking. There's been some action against communications and navigation satellites."
"Any messages from Florida or Sunnyvale?"
"None, sir."
"Messages from the lunar settlement?"
"Nothing to us, sir. They're far side to us now."
"I'm coming up to the Axis now. Tell Lincoln Pickney to set up a special situation room with seating for about 15 people. Roberta Pickney's voice interrupted.
"Gary, is that you? Everything's already set up. Kirchner's orders. He wants science and security coordinating on this. Get up here immediately."
In the elevator, surrounded by security personnel and baffled engineers who hadn't heard details yet, Lanier tried to think of all the things left to be done, all the preparations yet to be made. He felt his rough, unshaven chin. It had all been hypothetical, a long-running nightmare. Down below, where he had spent most of his life, where most of the people he loved, and how few they were, still lived, it was probably beginning. He couldn't block images of what people back home were doing at this moment. He had lived through it as a pilot, but never as a civilian, listening to radios, to sirens, to civil defense instructions, never comprehensive enough to be of real value. Orders to evacuate, issued over cable communications from neighborhood to neighborhood. People afraid, people throwing things into automobiles, or scrambling for buses, or trains, or civil defense trucks. He tried to quell such thoughts. He needed his wits about him. At the Axis chambers, the security guards organized the people into priority tram groups. He was plucked from the crowd by three young Marines and ushered almost forcibly into a special car. The center of stone external communications was a walled-off area about 20 meters square in one corner of the prime dock staging area. Six Marine corporals stood by the door, rifles at ready, their boots hooked into special loops to brace them in case they needed to aim and fire. Lanier passed between them. Inside the room, 10 people had gathered. They watched him closely as he pulled himself into a seat. 4 video screens were mounted in one wall. Innumerable repeaters had been wired into most of the consoles. Only one of the big screens was on, showing a fuzzy picture of the stone itself, surrounded by data readouts. That was a picture from the Drake, just as he had first seen the stone 4 years ago. Pickney handed him a pair of Velcro galoshes. "It hasn't started yet," she said, "but there's been an alert. Something's hit the fan, but we're not sure what it is. Put this on." She wrapped earphones and mic around his head. "I've been getting everything coordinated for the past half hour." "Orders yet?" "Nothing specific, just the alert." He sat where he was told, and a bank of keyboards and viewers was moved near to him. Captain Kirchner and his aide, a young mustachioed lieutenant commander dressed in khakis, entered a few minutes later and were seated a few meters away in similar accommodations. Kirchner, in charge of external stone defense, was really the central figure now. Gerhardt was in the first chamber, making preparations, but for the moment, what happened in the chambers was incidental. "Get 15 men outside the borehole with portable detection systems," Kirchner said. "I want them hidden behind those honeycomb walls, out of sight. No heat signatures. And get those goddamn Gatling guns in position." Quiet descended. Pickney, earphones clamped over her short bobbed hair, listened intently. A burst of static issued from a speaker on the other side of the room. On the largest screen before Lanier, a picture flicked on, wavered and steadied into crystal clarity. The source was a camera just outside the borehole, in the honeycombed dimple. The camera was oriented toward the Earth at that moment. The limb of the Earth, still in darkness, came into focus. The picture shuffled twice as enhancers did their work. Lanier could then make out continents, cloud patterns, city lights in the night. They were within a few minutes of being nearest in their orbital path to Earth, less than 3,000 kilometers. A crackly radio voice came over their headphones. "Heaven sent, heaven sent, this is Red Cube. Alert situation, remarkable." "Shit," Kirchner murmured. "Bears have just announced their end run. Captain Kirchner, we are devising responses now. Your situation is unknown. Please advise." "We are secure and making preparations," Kirchner said. Red Cube, the Joint Space Command Western Headquarters in Colorado, came back with, "You are now out of our response pattern, Captain. We must conduct affairs as if you did not exist. The steam in the sweatbox is thick. Looks like they're going to take out our near-Earth capability. Understood?"
"Understood. Hope to God you can keep them in line, Red Cube."
"Heaven sent is now on its own, Captain."
"Yes, sir."
The transmission ended. "My screen shows an OTV approach," Kirchner said. "Is it identified?" "OTV 45, carrying supplies and reinforcement personnel, launched 9 hours ago from Station 16, Pickney said. "We've been monitoring." Kirchner's aide confirmed that the Marines in the dimple had picked up a blip on their scanners. "Take it aboard," Kirchner said. "We're going to be getting a lot more in a day or so if this goes all out."
"Yes, sir. Several more launching already."
The screen before Lanier rolled up a picture of the OTV approaching the borehole. Suddenly, the OTV expanded into a glowing sphere. Silently, quickly, the sphere dissolved at its edges and darkened to dull orange. Debris scattered in silhouette against the diffuse shells of gas.
"Sir," Kirchner's aide said, "they're seeing dark transits out there, blocking stars, behind the OTV.
"The OTV's gone," Lanier said. "Captain, they've snuck in behind our ship."
"My God!"
exclaimed a voice over the hissing and crackling loudspeaker. Pinckney had opened the Marine's frequency to all the room.
"Something's taken out our ship. Am I seeing..."
"Transits.
Transits. No blips. Durbin here. I'm getting dark spots, but they have to be retinal."
"No way. I didn't see the flash, and I'm getting 4, 5, 6 transits blocking stars. Big suckers." "They're going to come down the pipe," Kirchner said. "Get the OTV tanks rigged to block them. Team A, release your cables." Cameras in the borehole showed ghostly infrared and low-light enhanced images of men in suits moving behind the first rotating dock. Mortar-like cannon fired coiled steel cable across the 100-meter diameter of the borehole. Harpoons fixed the cables in the opposite wall. 7 were fired in rapid succession, making a web in the borehole. 3 discarded OTV tanks were maneuvered up from the sides and fixed in position with more cables. All this was done in less than 10 minutes.
"They won't come into the staging area," as Kirchner said confidently. "It would be a waste of time. If they come down the pipe, they'll go for the chambers. They can mop us up later. I hope, however, soldiers are prepared."
In the commotion, Lanier had directed his eyes away from the screens displaying the earth. He returned his attention to them. Tiny orange spots blossomed along the Soviet coast west of Japan. Simple suborbital rockets deploying solid debris to bring down low-orbit satellites and battle stations.
"Pop-ups," Kirchner said.
One of the Marines outside the borehole said something garbled. Then, as Pinckney enhanced the reception, the voice continued,
"Sir, they're blowing the masks!"
The large screen switched to a view down the borehole. Stars twinkled beyond the flare-lit rotating dock and the outer lip of the borehole. 3 shadows moved against the stars. Then fire rimmed the shadows and pie slices of black material drifted away, revealing shapes difficult for the eye to define. The mirrored noses of the intruders were reflecting the dark interior of the borehole and the illuminated prime dock.
"Signature," Kirchner's aide said. "They're Russian. Ocean-launched heavy-lift cargo vehicles. First is in the pipe."
20 meters wide, the Russian ships resembled Christmas decorations as they entered the borehole. Invisible beams of energy from guns hidden beyond the rotating dock were already making parts of the leading heavy lifter glow orange. Lanier could not begin to keep track of what was happening. His eye moved from screen to screen. Kirchner spoke rarely now. The procedures had already been outlined. His men were doing all they had been trained to do, all they could do.
"Pinckney, patch me through to 7th chamber," Lanier said.
"Everyone's in 1st and 4th chambers by now," Gerhardt said.
"Then get me 4th chamber, wherever. I want Heinemann."
"Lead ship returning fire," said an anonymous voice from within the borehole. "Looks like they're aiming for the tanks, maybe the cables."
"Maybe they don't see the cables," another voice suggested. The tone of both soldiers was calm, expectant.
Lanier noticed a monitor showing the tiny star of Station 16 in low Earth orbit of 1,000 kilometers. As he watched, the star became a glowing smudge of white light. The light winked out.
"Heinemann on your button 5, Pinckney told Lanier. He punched the button.
"Lawrence, this is Gary.
I was almost out the door and they pulled me back in. I'm in 4th chamber, Gary. I was on my way.
Lawrence, we're being attacked. Just get to the V-stole and take it up. Hitch to the tube rider and take it down the line. Stay there until we call you back."
"Got you. I was on my way."
The button popped up and dimmed. More brilliant white flowers grew from pinpoints to blue-white smudges over Japan and China, 4 in all. These were orbital nuclear bursts designed to incapacitate communications and power nets with intense flashes of electromagnetic interference, the source of more static over the speakers. As the stone moved in its counterclockwise orbit, and as the Earth turned beneath them, he saw more bursts over the Soviet Union and Europe, 14 in all, a veritable nuclear springtime. They had upped the ante since the little death. No strategic exchanges yet, but no unshielded electronics or communication systems would survive these preliminary steps in the dance. The smaller view screens showed pictures intercepted from those scanning satellites still intact and broadcasting. The coast of North America, southern and Baja California, prominent, came into dawn, high-altitude glows casting an eerie light across the ocean and land, like pen lights on a relief map. The carnage still hadn't begun. What was the plan? Bluff? Deception? The negotiations would have begun already. What has been done? What will be done unless... How to scale back, defuse, settle for a limited confrontation? Who was bluffing whom, and how far they would go? Who would surrender? Chapter 23. Colonel Mirsky gripped the edge of the hatch leading to the ship's cockpit. There was no direct view of the borehole. The laser shield and armored outer hull covered the forward windows. He couldn't understand the displays before the two pilots. They were a confusion of vague lines, spinning circles, things like Easter eggs, rolling and processing in a grid pattern. "Get your men ready," the ship's commander said, glancing over his shoulder. "Tell them to stay close to the borehole walls until they exit into the first chamber. They have men with lasers waiting. Sting like bees." Heavy fists seemed to slam on the outside of the hull in a rapid tattoo. Alarms went off. "Naughty fellows, that was a Gatling gun," the co-pilot said. "Laser shields penetrated. Minor outer hull breach." Mirsky backed out and closed the hatch behind him, the commander's comment about bees still echoing in his mind. Mirsky had once tended bees on a city co-op in Leningrad as a student project. "We invade the hive," he thought. "Naturally, they try to sting." He floated across the first compartment, picked up his helmet, and issued terse instructions. The sergeants, squad leaders for the second and third compartments, pulled themselves through the hatches to alert their men. Minutes, and it would begin. "Why so glum, Alexei?" he chided a soldier, inspecting his helmet. "Friends, are your weapons charged?" They pulled their rifles out of a charging rack and checked the glowing LEDs. "Line up," Mirsky said. In the second and third compartments, he heard orders being barked. The first company commander, stationed in the first compartment, Major Konstantin Yulopov, was already in his helmet, with the cannon-bearer Zhadov tugging experimentally at the connections and seals on his suit. When he was given the okay, Yulopov would in turn assist Mirsky. None of them had much protection against laser or projectile hits. In this sort of warfare, an AKV or even a pistol, prepared for the vacuum, but with standard-issue bullets, was as effective against a soldier as anti-personnel lasers. Mirsky approached the small group surrounding Zev, Major General Sosnitsky. "A battalion is prepared, Comrade General," he reported. Sosnitsky's staff of three officers, with the Zampolit, Major Bilizersky, standing nearby, were checking and rechecking the general's suit like chicks around a hen. Sosnitsky lifted a gloved hand over the commotion and offered it to Mirsky. Mirsky grasped it firmly. "The marshal would be proud of you and your men," Sosnitsky said. "Today, or tonight, or whatever it is, will be glorious." "Yes, sir," Mirsky said. Even though his thoughts about the command structure bordered on the cynical, Sosnitsky had the power to make him feel emotion. "We will give them something back for Kiev, won't we, comrade?"
"That we will, Comrade General."
He glanced up at Bilizersky. The political officer's expression was a mix of exultation and borderline panic. His eyes were wide and his upper lip was damp. Mirsky wiped his own upper lip. Moist. His whole face was moist. Then he backed away from the group and resumed his position. The queuing lights near the three circular exit hatches came on, and the craft began its erratic tumbling, designed to offer unpredictable targets for marksmen as the soldiers leaped forth. It would also scatter them like chaff inside the borehole. The partners would grip each other's harnesses and jump as a group to stay together until they had their bearings. They would not fire randomly. There was more chance of hitting one another than an antagonist. Only in direct combat with clearly seen opponents would they fire, and they were not to waste their time even with that if it could be avoided. Everyone was suited and lined up. The emergency airlock surrounding number two exit hatch had been dismantled and stowed against the bulkhead. The pumps began to evacuate the compartments with throaty grumbles and a high pud-pud. The connecting hatches between the compartments slid shut. The lights were extinguished. The only thing Mirsky's soldiers could see now with the queuing lights above the exit hatches and the luminous glows of their guide ropes. "Check radios and locators," he said. Each soldier performed a quick diagnostic on his communications gear and the all-important beacon locator. The queuing lights flashed at half-second intervals. Everyone made sure they were connected to the trolley, which would guide and tug them around the compartments until it brought them to their exit hatch. 10 seconds until hatch opening. The motion of the ship, jerking, pitching, and rolling as its maneuvering jets fired unevenly, was beginning to affect even Mirsky. He could no longer hear the pumps. They were in vacuum. The hatches slid open abruptly, and the queues began to spill out into darkness and silence. 2 squads destined for the first chamber, 20 men in all, went out in the first queue. Mirsky was third in his queue. Yulopov went ahead, and Mirsky held him by a strap attached to his thigh. Mirsky, in turn, was held by Zhadov, who kept the laser cannon strapped to his side. The trio gripped the hatch edge and kicked away in unison, as they had been trained, flying from the craft like a precision skydiving team, a little star of 6 legs in the vast darkness. His eyes adjusted quickly, and he switched on his locator. For a heart-stopping moment, he thought all was lost. He could not even hear a whisper of signal. Then came the steady high-frequency chuff, chuff, chuff of the beacon, placed by some unknown compatriot, perhaps dead already, murdered by the Americans, in the borehole leading into the second chamber. And he could make out the tiny spot of light that was the opening to the first chamber. Stuff floating around, bumping, smearing, dark drops fuzzing out, large chunks of metal in his helmet beam, sections of torn bulkhead and rippling sheets of steel. A ship! Tangled in something invisible ahead, the wreckage of one of the heavy lifters vibrated ponderously, fly caught in a web, surrounded by drifting bodies, most without helmets. Pieces of limbs and trunks drifted past. A blinding nimbus surrounded them all. High-intensity spotlights played around the ships and their disgorged soldiers, dead and alive. Zhadov let go of Mirsky's strap, and Mirsky instinctively reached for the man's weapon, but caught his arm instead. The suit squirmed in his grip, and the body twisted fiercely, almost dragging Mirsky away from Yulopov. Zhadov's suit had been holed, and the venting gas whirled him about like a released balloon. Mirsky reached out as far as he could and gripped the cannon. He handed it to Yulopov. As clear as reality, clearer at the moment, he stood in a grassy field and contemplated this nightmare. He gathered his chute up from the yellow grass and shook his head, grinning at his imagination. Soldiers filled the borehole, hundreds of them, and all around he could instinctively feel the invisible laser needles and projectiles searching, piercing, picking away. Mirsky pulled Yulopov to him and swung his helmet beam around, looking for the wall they should be approaching. It was not visible. Zhadov's death had knocked them off course. "Use your rocket pack," he told the major. "We break up now." "Some potato," the major commented dryly, the voice-activated microphone cutting off the first sound of each phrase. "Shorter than an oven. Must be baked. Good luck, Colonel." Mirsky let go of the strap and fired his thruster. He swung outward, away from the entangled wreckage and awful corpses. He cut the thruster and switched on his helmet display. Before his eyes, the beacon and his relation to it appeared on a small luminous stage. He adjusted with another thrust, as did hundreds of his comrades. How many hundreds he could not say. He suddenly remembered the number of the entangled wreckage, now far behind. That had been the lunar ship, filled with those most recently and thoroughly trained for low-gravity combat, their best. Mirsky, alone now with his signal and his thruster, unconcerned for the moment about how many of his men were behind or ahead, flew down the borehole toward the tiny circle of light. "They've broken through," Kirchner said, slamming the side of his palm against the chair arm. "There's nothing in the borehole but bodies and wreckage. About 3 heavy lifters have backed out. They must have disabled the rest. Nobody's getting away, though. They can't go home." "The pilots will wait until we're taken," Gerhardt said wearily on the comlink. He was now overseeing evacuation of the civilian teams to the 4th chamber. "You don't sound in the best of spirits, Oliver," Kirchner said. "Your turn now." "We have some transmissions from the Persian Gulf," Pinckney said. "We can unscramble them. Captain, would you like to listen in?" Let's hear them, Kirchner said. A man's voice, sounding almost mechanical after the processing of the signal, said, 1K, that is kill 7, 1K, that is kill 7, have smoked the circle. Repeat, have smoked the circle. Vampires, 14 count, range 50 clicks. Source, Turgenev, small platform. Repeat, 14 vampires, 6 down. Sweep 2 commencing. Smoking circle, up with directed fry. 9 down, up with knives, 11 down. 3 vampires, 20 clicks. Priests out. Priests and vampires engage. Advising salamander crews. Starfish launched. Sea dragons alerted. 2 vampires, 6 clicks. Sweep 3 commencing. Foaming now. Short eyes out. Blades out. Guardians out. Knives inboard. A pause. 2 vampires, 3 clicks. Another pause, then softly, goodbye, Shirley. That's the cruiser House, Kirchner said quietly, rubbing his eyes with his hands. She's gone. Another, Pickney said. Coast of Oman. Let's have it, Kirchner said, glancing at Lanier. CVN-96, group hairball, the signal commenced. Second launch, Feather 2. Repeat, Feather 2. Commencing chigger. Repeat, chigger. Special fourth-class nuke. Postal authorities will advise. The carrier Fletcher is sending in strategic aircraft for a mid-range coast sortie, Kirchner translated. CVN-85, code Zorro, Dr. Betty. Postal authorities withdraw your permit. Claws will scratch chiggers. Sea dragons alerted. Slow wall up and turkey feathers down. Repeat, slow wall up and... Group hairball, leading man, groom, and Alpha Delta Victor. Best man, chambermaid, luncheon postponed. CVN-96, I count 38 vampires. Source, deep blue Turgenev class platform. Range, 10 clicks. Knives up, short eyes. Sea dragons alerted. Priests and vampires engage angels too. Jesus Christ. An obvious expletive, not code. There are 2 clicks. Kirchner flinched as the message was cut off. I should be down there, he said, right in the middle of the barbecue. How many OTVs did Station 16 get off, Lanier asked. Besides OTV 45? 5. 3 are coming for us, 2 for the moon. Warn the 3 we are under attack and may not be able to receive them. Suggest they divert to the moon.
If they can make it, Pickney said.
The evacuation of the low Earth orbit platforms and other stations had already begun. The war was expanding now. Not just beam defense platforms, but research and industrial stations were becoming targets.
Some diversion, Pickney said bitterly. Looks like it's getting out of control.
Of course it is, Gerhardt said on the comlink. Only an idiot or somebody very desperate would have thought otherwise. Gary, you done all you can there. I'll need you in the first chamber in a few minutes. I'm on my way back now. Chapter 24. Vasquez slept on a bunk beneath the tent, exhausted after 7 hours of intense work. 2 slates, an expanded processor, and several dozen sheets of paper littered the tent floor around the cot. Patricia, Carrollson, Farley, Wu, and Zhang, and of course Heinemann in the V-stole, made up the only group not confined to the first and fourth chambers. Lanier had decided her work was too important to stop completely. She dreamed about a drugstore on Earth. She was being refused the opportunity to buy an ice cream cone. The dream transformed, and she stood by a blackboard in a large classroom, trying to explain abstruse problems to a sea of unruly students. They began throwing pieces of chalk at her. With an absolute conviction of reality, she watched the chalk hit the equations on the board. "Hold it," she cried. "Stop!" The class ceased its commotion. She picked a piece of chalk off the floor and circled the areas of the equations that had been marked by hits.
"Of course," she said. "These would show..."
Carrollson grabbed her shoulder and shook her awake. Patricia pulled aside wisps of black hair and looked up at the woman through sleep puffy eyes.
"We have to get to the fourth chamber," Carrollson said. "Why? I'm working..."
"Work's over, honey. There's a truck waiting. The Chinese are going, too. All of us. Move." Her tone was acid. Patricia picked up her bag and stuffed the slate, memory blocks, multimeter, and processor into it. Carolson made as if to knock the bag out of her hands, then pulled back, arms clutching her own shoulders. "We don't need those now," she said. "We really don't." Tears slid down Carolson's cheeks and spotted the breast of her coveralls. "Everyone's saying it," she continued. "I haven't seen, but there's stuff coming in on that hookup, the one for filching satellite broadcasts." Patricia clutched the bag to her breast and ran ahead of Carolson to the truck, cursing under her breath. How funny she was behaving, she thought, in a part of her mind where reality had not yet penetrated. How hysterical. After all, she had known. She should have been prepared. Carolson, Wu, and John climbed into the truck behind her. Farley drove them up the ramp and into the tunnel. Chapter 25. Mirsky was terrified, pushed ahead by the vapor thrusters, periodically trailing a thin and quickly dissipating cloud of hydrogen peroxide. He aimed along the beacon. On every side, ground awaited him. His stomach told him he was falling in all directions. Ahead was a gray-black expanse. Clouds drifted in curving sheets above, below, behind, before. He could not close his eyes. He had to keep the helmet display centered on the beacon signal. He caught sight of several fellows, their thruster bursts resembling contrails from the wings of a jet drifting in and out of moist air. "How many?" he asked. "What countermeasures would the Americans have taken?" He had to cross this beautiful horror, this place without top or bottom, and fly down a second borehole. Only in the second chamber would he be able to drop away from the center and unfold his airfoil shield, following the simple map that would be projected on his helmet display. Slowly, his fear turned into exhilaration. The longest jump he had ever made on Earth had lasted for 6 minutes, better than lovemaking, better than the day he received his wings. But here he had been flying steadily, accelerating with each new burst, for 10 minutes, 15. If he died upon landing, it would be worth it. To have seen a place where the land was the sky, where he could dive any direction and come to ground. Worth it all. Worth even the nightmare of the borehole and the drifting, torn bodies of his comrades, faces bloated and livid in the vacuum, eyes protruding beyond their lids and ghastly white. "Psst, Colonel Mirsky, is that you?" "Yes, identify." "Shlopov, I've seen others from our ship, and hundreds more. Psst, air like angels, Colonel. First squads have dropped away. Look behind, Colonel." He carefully inclined his neck, keeping his eye on the beacon alignment, then looked behind and below. He could see tiny white dots, parachutes, in the bluish haze above the floor of the chamber. He twisted smoothly and saw more at another quadrant, coming down as planned to take control of elevator entrances in the first chamber's southern wall. Pride swelled in him. Who else could have even succeeded this far? History. He could see the darker hole in the center of the forward wall. None of them had more than 2 hours of air in their suit tanks. How much longer until he could drop away? In the fourth chamber compound, Carolson had given up trying to organize the members of the science team. Most of the security team had been deployed, leaving the barracks, cafeteria, and grounds to the evacuees. Patricia sat in the cafeteria, numb, snot crusted under her nose, half listening to the sporadic radio signals coming over the cafeteria loudspeakers. The signals from the external satellite feed were still being directed down the borehole to transponders at the entrance of each chamber. Electronic chatter of robots calmly sacrificing themselves in orbit, seeking orbiting outposts and battle stations, or going silent as they re-entered the atmosphere to search out a few million more human beings, enacting a deterrence policy now guaranteeing only more and more death. Out of control, Patricia thought. Spasm. The motions a dying person makes, or the twitches in a corpse. San Diego, Long Beach, Los Angeles, Santa Barbara. Spasm. Farley and Jong wept in each other's arms. Wu was silent and stolid, sitting on a table like a piece of sculpture. Rimskaya stood in a corner with a bottle of scotch, almost certainly contraband, taking a gulp every few seconds until he fell down. A few ex-defense workers, reverting to the old banter, the old assessments and guesses, conducted a calm analysis of who was winning, who was still capable of fighting, which hardened weapon sights would open next. Submarines under the ice caps? No. Both sides will hold those in reserve for after.
What after?
Who cares?
What about those trucks? You know, the reverse ground effect vehicles? Hug the ground when the shockwave passes over?
Fuck them all.
Spasm.
She closed her eyes as if to block an image of her home absorbing the sudden burst of light and radiation, becoming a carbonized mockery of walls and roof. And within, slightly protected by the shadow of the house, roasted alive but not quite carbonized, and then being blasted to fine ash by the shock wave, Rita and Ramon. Farley approached Patricia and tapped her on the shoulder, disrupting her reverie.
"We can't go back," she said. "The engineers say none of the spaceports are left by now. Vandenberg, the Cosmodromes, Kennedy Space Center, even Edwards, gone. We can't get to the moon either. Not enough ships or fuel. Nobody will come up for 10, maybe 20 years. That's what the engineers are saying. We might have a few good fields left in China, but there aren't going to be any shuttles in orbit to rendezvous with the OTVs, even if we could go back."
Wu joined them. "Nothing out of China now," he said. "Russia's still throwing things. Every city I live in. Gone by now. We used to get civil defense instruction in school. We knew where bombs would drop. Russian bombs and maybe even American bombs. Every city had its bombs."
"When's the funeral?" someone asked in the background. There was no laughter, only silence. It was an extraordinarily insensitive joke, except that it couldn't be a joke. There had to be a funeral when somebody died, but when billions of people were dead or dying?
Carolson sat down beside Patricia.
"Office ink is all there is," she said laconically. "Wayne is gone, and our son. They're dead by now, I'm sure. You know, in a little while this is going to hurt like hell. Adjusting is going to be..." Her cheeks twitched, spotted red, as if she were breaking out in a rash. "Rimskaya drank all the booze, the bastard."
"I'm going to the library," Patricia said.
"Can't," Carolson said. "Off limits."
"I need something to do."
"Of course." But she offered no suggestions.
"Hey, we have more pictures from the external cameras," someone yelled.
The widescreen video was wheeled out and connected to the central cafeteria hookup. Patricia did not look at the video screen. She had seen satellite and lunar telescope pictures of the conflagration in the Thistledown City Library. Somewhere on Earth, in Washington, or in Pasadena in Hoffman's office, copies of those pictures were being embraced by the destruction they depicted, an Ouroboros of doom. Carolson watched, however, eyes narrowed, lips drawn back. One by one, the cities blossomed. The atmosphere rippled over each explosion as if a giant steel ball had been dropped in a pond. Over the western limb, beyond the Atlantic, a brighter-than-dawn glow was creeping, now yellow, now purple, now green. The whole world was being swept by a crown fire, with the flames leaping not from tree to tree, but from city to city, continent to continent. People were no more substantial than pine needles. Chapter 26. Gerhardt and Lanier stood near several squads of soldiers guarding the entrance to the zero elevator. Gerhardt held up the field glasses. "Little specks," he said. "Mosquitoes. Most of them are coming down in this chamber, but quite a few appear to be crossing over." He handed the glasses to Lanier. "Into the second chamber?" The cool wind sliding down from the cap played with Lanier's hair. Lanier kept track of two of the specks in the glasses, following their contrails along the axis. He lowered the glasses to inspect the defenses around the two science team compounds.
"Yeah, expecting us to have a bigger force here, which we do."
He raised his glasses again and saw broader white dots at a much lower angle near the southern cap.
"Parachutes," Lanier said. "Some are in the atmosphere now."
"Jesus, what an effort," Gerhardt said in admiration. He picked up his radio.
"Zero south tunnels. Forces coming your way. Borehole. Keep your eyes open."
Lanier could not concentrate. He kept thinking of the diversion. Had they set fire to the world just to gain an advantage here, hoping they could control the results with negotiation, keeping the casualties close to those of the little death?
He suddenly grew sick of all the thousands of artificial modes of behavior conjured up by representatives of government, by military men, by patriots and traitors and fighters, and he wanted to crawl away and sleep. He could not keep from seeing in his imagination an image of Hoffman on the road to Vandenberg in her limousine, hoping to escape the madness, to leave the dying aircraft and bail out, to come here, where the madness had spread, and not making it anyway, facing the blasts over Vandenberg. "Do they know?" he asked. "Know what?" Gerhardt said. "Do the Russians know that death has come?" Gerhardt, who had never been in the library and had had none of Lanier's forewarning, frowned at him. "What are you asking, Gary?" Lanier pointed up. "They're about to engage us in battle, but do they know neither of us have supreme commanders anymore?" "Some leadership will survive," Gerhardt said. "Oliver, does it matter?" "You're goddamn fucking right it matters," Gerhardt screamed at him, spittle beating on his chin. He wiped it away with the sleeve of his overalls, shaking his head and turning away, face reddening. "Don't go under now, Gary. We need everybody we can get." "I'm going to fight," Lanier said. "It won't be the first time, will it?" Gerhardt asked, his voice strained and harsh. "On the ground, yes." Modes of behavior. No rest, no end, even after doomsday. "Where's my weapon?" They had made it through the second borehole, despite sporadic fire from troops stationed there. More had died, but not many. Would he ever stop falling? Mirsky spun in his path to survey the city. He had never seen such a city. As his thrusters pushed him 100 meters away from the borehole, then 200, then 3, he spotted the landmark he was after, the zero bridge spanning the chamber-circling river, and pushed himself away from the potato's axis toward the thin glow of the plasma tube. Other soldiers had already fallen free through the atmosphere barrier and the plasma tube. Their informant had assured them passage was safe as long as they did not linger, but Mirsky trusted only experience and survival. He could not see whether his comrades were alive or dead. When he saw them at all, they were too tiny to make out details. They were dwarfed. How could a few hundred soldiers command an object as big as a republic? The perspective changed very slowly as he fell away from the axis. He felt no wonder whatsoever at how selfish his emotions were now, and how much hate filled him. Mirsky had felt these emotions many times before, during training or the horrid endurance tests. These were the emotions of soldiers in battle, hard and bitter, touched with fear but mostly with overwhelming self-interest. He could not have cared less about the state, the motherland, the revolution. There was no shame in him. Only falling, spiraling outward as the great cylinder turned around him. He kept pace with the landmarks, using his thrusters. Silence, not even the sound of wind yet. He prepared his air sled, fanning out and locking its segments. Then he noticed he was drifting some degrees away from the bridge. He corrected with another thruster burst. There was so little sensation he might go mad, and yet he had been falling for only a minute or so, very slowly. He felt, perhaps only in his mind, a tingle, and knew he was passing through the plasma tube. Below that, but only by a few hundred meters, lay the upper limits of the atmosphere, beyond the restraining barrier. He braced himself behind the sled and strapped his arms and legs to the concave inner surface. Whatever angle he first brushed the atmosphere, the sled would flip him around to the shape of least resistance. He would plummet through the upper air until he could hear the whistle of its passage. Then he would kick free of the sled and begin his 15 or 16 kilometer dive, releasing the chute only 2 or 3 kilometers from the floor of the chamber. He would be lighter, falling. The impact would not be very hard at all. Another soldier came close enough to wave, one he didn't recognize, with the insignia of 6th Battalion, from Rolls-Royce. Mirsky waved back and motioned for him to prepare his sled. The soldier held it up, folded, in tatters from a projectile impact, and shrugged, flipping it aside. They were to maintain radio silence, but the soldier used his rockets to approach close enough that they could read lips. "Can I survive without?" "I don't know. Tuck up into a ball and present your back to the air, if you can."
That was difficult to convey with lip movements, so Mirsky mimed by folding himself up as best he could behind the shield, drawing up his knees and wrapping his arms around him. The soldier nodded and signaled okay with his thumb and index finger. They drifted apart, the soldier falling more slowly because of his thrust toward Mirsky. Mirsky watched the soldier thrust again to move away from the cap surface, toward which he was drifting, and then busied himself preparing for the entry. He checked his position with relation to the bridge. One more adjustment with the thrusters. He could feel some pressure now against the sled. A vibration. Weak nudges. He made one more thrust, and then unfastened and discarded the rocket pack. Where it fell, he did not care, so long as it didn't land on him. For an instant, through the preparations and the near fury of anticipation, he looked again at the city and wondered what the potato's secret actually was. Why were they fighting for it? What could it bring them? How would the West react, facing the theft of its greatest prize, or the attempt, he had heard rumors, to take out its orbital platforms and spy satellites? How would Russia react in the same circumstances? He shuddered. The sled jerked and whirled around. He blacked out for a moment, then came awake to a bone-crushing slam and a high-pitched, wavering scream. Coming down. The sled swung around again and bucked, but was now committed to one orientation. He was pressed against its inner surface, padded elbows and knees braced, hoping he had broken no bones. It had been more violent than the falls from 3 meters in training. He tasted blood in his mouth. He had bitten almost through his inner cheek. He could flap the tissue with his tongue. He closed his eyes against the pain and gathered up his chute in the golden grassy field, smiling at the burning sun, looking for his comrades, shielding his eyes to spot the distant specks of the transport plane, and fell. He hastily unbuckled from the sled. The air roared around him. Then he grasped the straps loosely in his hands. He flipped the sled over, and it was torn from his fingers. Made it. From here on, it was a simple free fall and parachute exercise. He tucked to roll and spread his arms and legs to flatten out and stabilize. The bridge was still only a line of white over the blue-black river. Was it really the right bridge? Really the Zero Bridge? Yes. He could spot the tiny speck of a guard shack nearby and make out lines of defense and sandbag emplacements. And he couldn't have fallen so far wrong as to traverse a third of the chamber's arc. He was right on. Too close, in fact. He would have to drift away some. The wind hummed mildly past his helmet now. He checked his laser and Kalashnikov and made quick surveys of his equipment belt. Chute release had to be gauged purely by eye. There was no sense counting from the axis, since everyone would fall at a different rate. He held out his thumb. It covered the length of the bridge. He pulled the ripcord and the chute leaped away, billowed, collapsed, and billowed again, spreading wide in the shape of a package of small sausages. Mirsky jerked and dangled and gathered his guidelines in both hands, pulling one, then the other, spilling a little air from one side of the chute to move in one direction, then from the other side. He saw with relief that he would land some 5 kilometers from the objective, unless they had far more men than reported, and radar-aimed automatic guns within the chambers, which their informant had told them they did not. They would probably not bring him down. He saw others coming down beside him and above him, only a few below. In all, hundreds of them. Mirsky tried to hold back tears and could not. Chapter 27 "Where's Patricia?" Carrollson looked around the mess.
"I don't know," Farley said. "She was here a few minutes ago. We should go find her."
"I'll go," Carrollson said. She had to get outside anyway. She wasn't sure she could stand the scene in the cafeteria any longer. She stepped out under the tube light and looked back and forth across the compound, her eyes fixed on something astonishing. Against the dark gray southern cap, tiny points of white were falling like snow. Dozens, then hundreds of them. A marine ran by carrying 2 apples. "Look," she cried, pointing and turning a half circle. No one paid her any attention. The marine jumped onto the tailgate of one of the fully loaded troop trucks rumbling out of the compound. Carrollson shook her head to clear it. She was drunk with grief and anger. Any solid thought seemed to be vomited away by a nauseated mind. She couldn't afford such a handicap now. She had to think clearly, and she had to find Vasquez. On the opposite side of the compound, a train pulled away from the elevated station. She glanced at her watch. As scheduled, the fourth chamber stop, 1400 hours. The platform was empty. None of the trains were being used for troops, only trucks. The trains were doing their automatic best to keep everything normal. Jesus, she said, suddenly realizing. Vasquez had wanted to return to the library. Which one did she mean? Farley ran up beside her.
We're being invaded, she said, astonished. Paratroopers, Russian soldiers, cosmonauts, whatever they are, they've come down in the first and second chambers. They're coming down here, too.
I've seen them, Carrollson said. Patricia's gone to the library. We have to find her.
How? The train's gone. Not another for half an hour. We can't take a truck. They're all in use.
Carrollson had never felt so helpless and out of place. She stood with fists clenched, facing the southern cap. Most of the parachutes had descended below their line of sight. Patricia stared at the seat ahead of her, biting her lower lip. Nobody was guarding the train. That was either an oversight or a providential. She had been in a dream ever since leaving Earth. Was it possible to be trapped in a dream?
In a dream, you can do anything if you learn how to control, to shape and command.
And the equations hit by the chalk. If what she had seen in the equations was correct, then at this very moment there was a place, a curve, where Father sat in his chair reading Tiempos de los Ángeles, and the corridor would pass right near it. She only had to search for the right door, the right section of the corridor, and she could find Rita and Ramon, Paul and Julia. She could hardly wait to tell Lanier. He would be pleased. Rimskaya would be proud he had recommended her. She had solved the secret of the corridor, the last pieces of the puzzle falling into place in a dream, no less. She could take them all home again.
The train came to her stop, and she exited, climbing the stair to the ground level.
Miss Vasquez.
Patricia turned to face a man she had never met before. He sat on the concrete edge of the underground entrance. His hair was black and short, and he wore a close-fitting black suit.
Excuse me, she said, her eyes not really focusing on him. She was in the grip of a powerful working state. I don't know who you are. I can't stay.
Nor can we. You must come with us. A tall creature with a head almost as narrow as a board and jutting eyes rose from behind the ceiling. Its shoulders were wrapped in silvery fabric. Otherwise, it wore nothing. Its skin was smooth as fine leather and just as brown. She stared, inner concentration evaporating.
Things are in quite a riot here, aren't they? The man said.
Patricia realized that he had a nose but no nostrils. His eyes were pale blue, almost blank, and his ears were large and round.
Excuse me, she said more softly. I don't know who you are.
My name is Olmi. My companion is a friend. They don't have names. I hope you don't mind our intruding. We've been watching everybody very closely.
Who are you? Patricia asked.
I lived here centuries ago, Olmi said, and my ancestors before me. For that matter, you could be one of my ancestors. Please, we don't have time to talk. We must leave.
Where?
Down the corridor.
Really?
That's where my home is. The Frant and his people come from elsewhere. They... Well, working for us doesn't quite describe it. The Frant shook its head solemnly.
Please don't be frightened, it said, its voice like a large bird's, low and warbling.
A breeze from the northern cap pushed through the outskirts of the third chamber city, rustling the nearby trees. Following the breeze came a slender craft about 10 meters long, shaped like a cone flattened lengthwise, with the nose truncated. It drifted gracefully around a tower and landed on the point of a single central pylon.
You've done some remarkable work, Olmi said. There are people where I live who will be very interested.
I'm trying to go home, Patricia said.
She realized she sounded like a lost child speaking to a policeman.
Are you a policeman? Do you guard the cities?
Not always, Olmi answered. Please come with us, the Frant said, stepping forward on long and oddly bent legs.
You'll kidnap me?
Olmi held out his hand. Whether supplicating or indicating the situation was not his to control, she could not say.
If I don't go willingly, you'll make me.
Make you? He seemed puzzled, then said, You mean force you? Olmi and the Frant exchanged glances. Yes, Olmi said.
Then I had better go with you, hadn't I?
Her words seemed to be spoken by a distant and heretofore unknown Patricia, calm and better versed in the analysis of nightmare. Please, the Frant said, until things are better here.
Things are never going to be better here, she said.
Olmi took her hand with a courtly bow and led her to the open oval hatchway in the craft's flat nose. The interior of the craft was confined, a T expanding at the rear, the walls like abstract billows of polished marble, all white curves. Olmi took hold of a soft bulkhead and stretched it out to form a couch. Please, lie here. She lay in the softness, the substance firmed up beneath her, molding to her body. The narrow-headed, knock-kneed brown Frant climbed farther back through the whiteness and nestled into its own couch. Olmi pulled out a section across the aisle from Patricia and sat in it, again touching his torque. He smoothed his hand over a bulge before him, and the curved surface erupted into an intaglio of black lines and red circles. Beside her, the whiteness faded to an elongated transparency, forming a long elliptical window. The edges of the window remained milky, like frosted glass. We're going to leave now. The third chamber city glided away beneath her. As the craft banked, the window filled with the austere grayness of the northern cap. I believe you'll truly enjoy where we're going, Olmi said. I've grown to admire you. You have a remarkable mentality. The Hexamon will be impressed, too, I'm sure.
Why don't you have a nose? The distant Patricia asked.
Behind them, the Frant made a sound like an elephant grinding its teeth. Chapter 28 The Soviet troops assigned to the second chamber had come down on a 200-meter-wide strip of parkland separating the river from the southern cap. The squads had regrouped at two points on opposite sides of the Zero Bridge, each about 3 kilometers from that objective. Communications with the squads on the opposite side of the bridge were good. Mirsky's group had taken shelter in a dense forest of gnarled pines. They had determined the bridge was heavily guarded and would soon be reinforced. They had to strike now. The equipment had not yet been dropped from Zhiguli, Heavy Lifter 7, and fully 3/4 of the 30 squads were not up to full strength. Attrition in the borehole had been hideous, and of those who survived the borehole, about 1 out of 20 had not completed the journey and parasail drop. The squads were designed for flexibility. Surviving sergeants shepherded broken squads together to form new ones. Mirsky had only 210 soldiers in his immediate command, and of course, little hope of getting more. Nobody knew how many had survived the drops in the other chambers. 20 Spetsnaz diversionary troops assigned to Mirsky's battalion, communicating by radio after swimming the river, had established lookouts in the second chamber city. They had been in the chamber for 2 hours now. The NATO troops at the bridge had not made an offensive move. This worried Mirsky. He knew that in the defenders' situation, the best plan would be an immediate and devastating offensive. They could conceivably have attacked as his men came down from the Axis. Apparently, they had been confused and not yet up to strength. Between his group and the objective, there was the forest and several broad concrete foundations of unknown utility. While there was sufficient cover for his troops momentarily, the cover could easily be turned into a series of disastrous pin-downs. General Zev, Major General Isosnitsky, had survived his descent into the second chamber, but had been injured on landing, breaking both legs when his parasail ripped at 100 meters. He was now sedated, lying concealed in a copse of trees and guarded by 4 soldiers Mirsky could ill afford to do without. The political officer, Bilizersky, had, of course, survived also, and stayed very close to the general like a hopeful vulture. Mirsky had spent a few weeks training with Sosnitsky in Moscow. He respected the major general. Sosnitsky, about 55, but as fit as any 30-year-old in the training regiments, had taken a shine to Mirsky, and no doubt it had something to do with his rapid promotion on the moon. No one of higher rank than colonel had come down in the second chamber besides Zev. Effectively, that meant Mirsky was in control. Garabedian had survived the drop, and that gave Mirsky some assurance. He could hope for no better deputy commander. Mirsky led three squads to the forward concrete structure, still a kilometer from the bridge. The top of the foundation was flat and covered about 300 square meters. The upper surface offered no protection. The concrete was 2 meters high, practically a wall behind which they could walk upright. Even such protection wasn't enough, however. Mirsky worried about the firing angles and opportunities offered by the chamber's curve. Did the enemy have lasers or small projectile weapons that could penetrate 20 or 30 kilometers of air? If they did, his men could be picked off easily, wherever they hid. He aimed the radio at the southern borehole and searched for the transponder signal. Finding it, he transmitted a message to Lieutenant Colonel Pogodin in the first chamber, asking how many troops he had and what his situation was. Pogodin had been aboard Chaika with Nev. "I have 400, Pogodin returned. "Nev is missing. Colonel Smirdin is badly wounded. He probably won't live. Have captured 2 compounds and taken 10 prisoners. We control 0 elevator." From the fourth chamber, Major Rogoff reported 100 men in position, but no objectives taken. The tunnels were heavily defended. He was contemplating moving his men to an island by rubber rafts captured at a recreation site. Rev had not survived the collision of Chevy with obstacles in the borehole. Colonel Eugene was dead, and there was no sign of battalion commander Lieutenant Colonel Nikolaev. The command structure was in a shambles. The hatred rose in him again, making his throat clutch and his stomach burn. "Fan out and pick your targets," he ordered the squad leaders on the near side of the bridge. He waved his arm to both sides and stayed behind the concrete to direct the other squads. A rattle of small arms fire greeted his men as they broke cover and spread in groups of 20 for trees and other foundations to either side of Mirsky. There was no way of telling how many laser weapons were being used. They were silent and invisible, except in moist or dusty air. He lifted his radio and spoke with the captain in command of the squads on the far side of the bridge. "Crossfire," he said. "Rush and divert." Then he called up another 3 squads and ran them in a different pattern toward the river shore, where they took firing positions in the woods and behind a circular foundation. With his binoculars, he could make out the faces of the defenders behind their plastic shields. His men had no such shields. Only his binoculars were proofed against laser blinding, if the defenders possessed such systems. Almost any laser cannon could be converted to spread a barrage of blinding beams. There were any number of weapons the NATO troops could have and could use, which he did not. The defenders had set up sandbags in lines paralleling the bridge road. Not all the positions were manned. If he could get his troops to the lines before the positions were up to strength, they would have almost a clear run to the bridge. He popped up to sweep the positions again with his binoculars and then dropped down to pass instructions to the opposite squads. The air was broken by a hideous crackle. Mirsky's eyes widened and he subconsciously prepared for death. He should have known the Americans would have something advanced and deadly up their sleeves. They were fiends for surprise weapons. The crackle sounded again and was followed by an extremely loud voice. The voice spoke Russian with a strong German accent, but the words were clear. "There is no need for fighting. We repeat, there is no need for fighting. You may hold your present positions for the moment, but do not advance any farther. It is imperative you listen. There has been a disastrous exchange of nuclear weapons on Earth." Mirsky shook his head and switched on the radio again. He could not waste time listening. "We have sufficient weapons and personnel to annihilate you. There is no need. You have compatriots among us already, the Russian science team, and there is corroboration from your comrades in the heavy lifters. Your communications can be fed through to them. They are waiting outside the borehole." Mirsky pressed the transmit button and ordered the attack forward. He then ordered his remaining squads to take the river shore and join up with their opposites beneath the bridge abutment. The cover looked good to that point,
and once beneath the bridge, they could fire along the Americans' lanes of sandbags and prevent them from being manned.
"Fighting us is useless. Our supreme commanders are dead or out of communication, perhaps for years. Your deaths would be meaningless. You may hold present positions, but signify your acceptance, or we will open fire."
Then another voice identified itself, distorted but familiar to Mirsky. Lieutenant Colonel Pletnyov, squadron commander of the heavy lifters. Either he had capitulated, or he was still outside the borehole. There was no way he could have been captured. He would have died in the borehole entry, not been taken alive.
"Comrades, our countries are at war on Earth. There is devastation in both the Soviet Union and the United States. Our plan is no longer effective."
The hell with him. Mirsky moved his men up from both sides. "Take this objective, and then the next, and then perhaps talk."
"Psh, Commander Mirsky," his radio hissed. "Enemy reinforcements crossing the bridge."
The gunfire started again, and Mirsky, for the first time in his life, heard the screams of dying men.
Chapter 29.
Heinemann squirmed in the V-Stole's pilot seat, listening to the exchanges in Russian, English, and German. Transponders in the boreholes were automatically carrying radio signals from chamber to chamber and down the corridor. Why hadn't they been switched off? Perhaps they had. Perhaps he was picking up signals from Russian transponders. He had propelled the tube rider beyond any conceivable danger. He was now 1,000 kilometers down the corridor, stationary on the singularity, feeling useless. End of side 5.